Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and this is the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On today's show, author David Shields visits us in the studio to talk about That Thing You Do With Your Mouth. LARB editor Sarah Mesley is in the studio making the case for a book called The Royal We by Jessica Morgan and Heather Cox. First-time author Parnaz Furutan is here to talk about her novel, The Girl from the Garden, which will be published tomorrow. We're taping, and this will be a few weeks hence, but she came in to talk to us the day before her publication date, and we are jazzed to talk to her. We want to apologize to BJ Novak again, who was kind enough to come back, but we became so enthralled in our conversation with Dana Johnson that we didn't notice the time ran over, and once again, we had to bump BJ. Tom, will you personally apologize to him for us?
We are so sorry, BJ. We will get you on next week if you can possibly come back again. Thanks.
Joining me on this incredibly hot day at our International World headquarters is the professor, the founder of the Los Angeles Review of Books, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Yes, us.
And writer, editrix, gal about town, Oscar Hammerstein expert, Nazi hater, Lori Weiner.
Hi, Seth.
David Shields is the author of 20 books. He's the recipient of Guggenheim and NEA fellowships. He's published essays and stories in the New York Times. And I thought his latest book was an anthology he co-edited with Elizabeth Cooperman called Life is Short, Art is Shorter, in Praise of Brevity, which makes me feel like I'm already running long. But David, your most recent project is really That Thing You Do With Your Mouth. Welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
The book is a pretty unusual project, and why don't you describe what it is and how it came about?
Yeah, it's, you know, as all of my books are, it has an incredibly long title and subtitle. It's That Thing You Do With Your Mouth, The Sexual Autobiography of Samantha Matthews as Told to David Shields. And the book is a book I co-wrote with my cousin once removed. I would see her every summer when she'd visit her family, and I had heard that she had a moonlighting job as a dubber of Italian porn into English in a Barcelona film studio. And if that's not a metaphor for something, I don't know what is. So every summer I see her, I say, "So Samantha, have you turned that experience into a Ross McElwee-like self-reflexive documentary film? Have you turned it into a Mary Gateskill-like short story? Have you turned it into a Katherine Harrison-like personal essay?" I just thought it was terribly rich material, especially because she had divorced her Spanish husband, for whom she had moved to Barcelona. I had a rather glib theory that, of course, the porn watching and dubbing was not unrelated to the divorce. So anyway, I kept on urging her every year for maybe 10 summers. Finally, out of who knows what desperation and whimsy, I suggested, "How about if we do the project together? I'll just ask you a bunch of questions, and we'll see if we can't conjure up a 20-page story, a novella, a memoir, something." And as with all good projects, the project jumped the proverbial tracks. The porn stuff became relatively minor, but the core of the book is Samantha tunneling down into her psychosexual life, especially because she believes herself to have been formatted by being abused and molested by her stepbrothers between ages 2.5 and 5. And so the book becomes that, you know, we had 800 pages of transcript between us over 2 years of emailing back and forth. And my job was to curate and collage into a 110-page monologue, which explores the question of to what degree can someone such as Samantha overcome original trauma.
And as you winnowed it down, you winnowed yourself out completely.
I did. At one point, I suggested the book would be a dialogue a la the book I did in January with my former student, Caleb Powell. I think you're totally wrong. A quarrel. And I proposed that to Samantha, in which I'd upload my sexual psyche, and just that we'd compare notes almost, and she just said no thanks, you know, not in any prudish way, because she certainly is no prude, but just like that this project caught her at an incredibly vulnerable moment of a relationship coming undone, psychotherapy not being effective, her career stalled, a lot of alcohol, and she kind of wanted someone to be a sounding board consultant, and she says, no, you know, I'm on the grill. I want to explore myself here.
I have a friend who's a playwright, and she says that the play has to know more than any character in it knows. And that may not be true for autobiography. You know, that might be an exception. This is such a hybrid. I'm wondering, do you think it is largely an autobiography, and do you think the book knows more than your subject knows?
Yeah, I think I see lacunae in what she says. I see gaps in what she says. In a way, the tradition of the book is things like Marguerite Duras's The Lover, Dostoevsky's Notes from, I'm not comparing it to these books in its scope, but Notes from Underground, Camus' The Fall, Catherine Harris's The Kiss, basically underground human text in which a very damaged narrator tunnels down into himself or herself. And if the reader wants to, the reader can distance herself and say, that person is really messed up. But if the reader has the empathy and the imagination, you can see how the narrator's extreme psychic distress actually rotates out as a larger metaphor for most people's experience. To me, if the book works at all, it's not about Samantha per se or even sexual trauma per se, but the way in which any human being with any kind of intelligence or experience probably is working through some kind of original trauma.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. We are talking to author David Shields on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM.
Started to feel at some point that this was all a big hoax on your part, and that there is, I mean, Samantha Matthews is not her real name.
It's not.
Right? And in fact, I started to think it's not anybody's real name. This is David Shields. He's said he hates the novel, so he can't write a novel. So he's going to pretend that this novel that he wrote is actually a piece of nonfiction.
I wish I were that clever. I remember that when I did an earlier book, Bret Easton Ellis accused me of doing the same thing. Alas, that's not true here. I mean, I'd want to undermine the question in the sense that who's to say that in my taking 800 pages of wandering text, remaking it in my own voice and vision, to what degree is that not a work of fiction?
Mm-hmm. Well, this seems to be like a direct outgrowth of two of your more recent books, both Reality Hunger, because she exists, Samantha, whatever her name in fact is, and Life is Short, Art is Shorter. And it's the apotheosis of those two books, in
totally.
Fact. So,
thank you. I mean, that's totally the way I see these books, that Reality Hunger is the theory, and this book is the practice.
And also in a way that can be very accessible.
Yeah, it's not, this is not highfalutin stuff.
That's the thing. The subject matter brings it down from the realm of esoterica, out of the realm of theory, and to the realm of something people might actually want to read.
You're completely buying this hoax, aren't you, Seth?
I'm completely taken in by it.
Well, you know, like I'm starting to really sweat here because I'm afraid the hoax is going to, I'm going to say the one line that reveals that it was a hoax.
The public shaming becomes extraordinary.
Right.
I know.
The J.T. Leroy thing, that woman is still recovering from what occurred in
that
instance.
We should let you win the awards first and then they can yank them later. I'll drop that line of questioning.
Like Gunter Grott. No, it's a huge question. And I do a whole chapter, alas, in Reality Hunger on Fry Leroy et al. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by it, in which in this hyper-literal age in which we live, hyper-digital, extremely litigious, what I call trial by Google, in which every work of essayistic adventurousness gets run through this bizarre literal truth meter. It's basically an attempt to define down nonfiction as being a subset of journalism rather than a subset of literature. There's a tradition going back at least 2 millennia about great works of poetic essayistic art. But instead, now, as journalism is almost becoming irrelevant as a form, there's an attempt amidst public discourse to pretend that there is such thing as printing reality in the New York Times or anywhere else. And what happens, I think, is that works of nonfiction get shamed as nonfiction and journalism try to hold on toward the last vestiges of their commercial life. And I'm terribly invested, as I'm sure you can tell in my rising voice, in trying to frankly rescue nonfiction back to its great roots and not turn it into this very narrow memoiristic or journalistic or scholarly thing. The whole greatness of nonfiction is its nonness. It's the genre which defies genre. And I'm trying to reclaim that. I'm not the only person. There are hundreds of fellow travelers.
Now, the way you constructed it, though, your sense of character, that's a novelistic sense of character. I mean, even the Confessions, it's not
of
a
Rousseau?
Great... No, I'm thinking of Augustine.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're not a great novel yet. That is not a great novelistic character, not a great novelistic set of tensions and resolutions. Mm-hmm. This is constructed like a novel rather than like an essay.
That's interesting. I mean, I'd push back against, I really hate it when people say, this book is so well written, it's as if it's a novel. It's a very common rhetorical trope. In fact,
I guess that's what I'm
in
saying.
In fact, it wasn't, I mean, I find that trope in LA Review of Books issues number 14, 18, 19, and 27. But in what way, Tom, does it strike you as, quote, novelistic?
Well, I'm just thinking it's not The Education of Henry Adams. It's not...
A richly discursive sort of...
Yeah, which is, he's reflecting, but it's not, I mean, you don't go there for emotional honesty in the same way.
I see what you mean.
Right? And you don't go there for a kind of development of a character.
Uh-huh.
Right? He kind of resists that development of that character. And even Boswell's Johnson, it doesn't have what you're doing here in the way that some of the great novels do.
Interesting. I mean... Well, I'm still trying to avoid admitting that this is a novel. You're getting me close, but I'm not quite there yet.
Well, maybe we'll have to have you back again another time to do that. The book is That Thing You Do With Your Mouth. David Shields, thanks so much for coming to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you, guys.
LARB senior editor Sarah Messley has been kind enough to come back to the show to talk to us about what she's been reading. Welcome back, Sarah.
So a couple of books I'd like to recommend. The first is The Royal We by Los Angeles natives Jessica Morgan and Heather Cox, famous for writing the 11-year-old fashion blog, Go Fug Yourself, which is some of the smartest social commentary.
Oh, yeah. I love that blog.
That I think is around. And this novel, that it's their first adult novel that it came out this summer. It is a fantastic, I would say beachy reading, but it doesn't need to be limited to the beach. It's a popular, fun romance that is 600-some pages long, really deftly crafted, really well works at the level of the sentence. So as just sort of sheer pleasure reading on an extremely ambitious and charming scale, and also really smart about reading and storytelling and celebrity cultures, I just cannot recommend it enough.
What's it about?
It is a imaginary retelling of Kate Middleton and Prince William's marriage.
Fantastic.
Oh. Yeah, so it's through the view of an American who goes to study abroad at Oxford and falls in love with Nick, the guy in her dorm who is the prince. So it's amazing, too, for these critics who are always reading celebrity culture to write from the position of somebody who is now has to learn to be examined by the tabloid press. So it's just a really smart reading of how personality is constructed. But I really want to emphasize total wish fulfillment genre reading, just like a great, ambitious novel.
And once again, the name of the book is?
The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan.
And one of the things they're great at are these, they always sound like they're really sorry to have to tell somebody how ugly their clothes are, right? They're very
like rigorous and also generous, right? Like,
yeah.
I just interviewed them for LARB and they're so smart, but they really think of themselves as doing a call and response with celebrity culture in the way that you and I do, or all of us do with books and with movies, right? These personalities are being put forth to be read, and they are in dialogue with, you know, these great artists of our age, the PR rep, right? So, I mean, they are smart, funny women, and
yes. This
novel is a really great indulgence of all of those pleasures. And, I mean, a great sort of, like, true lovey fairy tale, right?
It's an interesting way to read the culture that PR reps are the great artists of the day. Talk about that a little bit.
I mean, I sort of said that off the cuff. And as soon as I said that, I thought that it's true, right? Like the way in which Rihanna wants to become Rihanna and has a team of artists who are like, okay, what is this personality going to be? How are we going to manifest it? Where are you going to go? What are you going to wear when you go there? And thinking about form and content, right? The aesthetics of context is this thing that PR, you know, it's like that is the art that PR people are meant to do. It's not just be nice, be it popular, right? It's thinking about like these particular niches that could be filled and how you're going to fill that with these really kind of subtle aesthetic decisions.
My father was convinced that the Beatles were completely constructed by a PR team and that the hair, that's why they all had the same haircuts.
But that was the Monkees.
No, I know, but he was convinced that the Beatles were. And I remember him just in disgust one day walking past and seeing an album cover and saying, oh, so now they all have beards. Great.
My father thought the Beatles caused the Vietnam War.
Okay, I think that's a different topic. But thanks for telling us about this novel, Sarah.
Sarah Messley, thanks for coming back in and talk to us again.
Absolutely. Bye, Seth.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. The author Parnaz Furutan has joined us today. She is publishing her first novel, actually. This is being taped, but the first novel by this author is going to be published tomorrow, actually. So thank you for making time in your schedule to join us.
Thank you for having me.
It's got a lovely review from PW. I was just looking at, they say that your sumptuous prose paints a vivid portrait of a rarely explored historical and cultural setting. Tell us just briefly about the plot of the book.
Well, the plot focuses on the experience. It's actually a true story. The experience of my ancestors. There were these brothers in Kermanshah. They're Jewish brothers, and they were very wealthy. And the eldest brother, he couldn't have a child, no matter how hard he tried.
We should say also at this point that you're Persian by extraction, and this is set in
Iran. So Kermanshah is a province of Iran, and this story is set in 1917 Iran, roughly. This older brother, he can't have a child, and so he takes a second wife, and she fails to conceive as well. So we find out that the fault of infertility is his, but no one mentions that, of course. And
that's nice of them.
No. If it's the woman, she's publicly humiliated.
Right.
But if it's the men's, we just pretend.
We don't mention it.
Nothing.
And Iran is so different now.
You know? Yeah. So they get rid of the second wife. And the younger brother feels so awful about this situation that he takes his newborn, his infant son, and he gifts it to his brother. And that child's mother, you know, becomes depressed and dies. And that's the story.
Well, okay.
And it's framed in Los Angeles. It's told by an older woman living in Los Angeles, and it's her family's history.
It's her family's history. And she begins with this question of how did my mother die? And there's a conflicting narrative about how that woman dies. You ask some people, and they say she died from the complications of womanhood, because back then women just fell over and died. And then you ask others, and they say, well, she died from sorrow. You know, there's a particular form of solid. It's called derg. It's very difficult to translate into English. Der is like this. it comes from feeling so oppressed that you can't voice your suffering, so it just sort of chokes you.
There's a kind of Persian relation to deep sadness, which is a part of the culture, right?
Yes.
And I witnessed it at the tomb of Hafiz.
Oh, you were there?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Where people would, a little bird would pick a verse for them out of a box, and they would take the verse and they would read it and weep on the tomb, holding onto the tomb.
Yeah.
Absolutely unashamed of the public display of this kind of sadness. It's part of the culture in a way that we are not used to in the U.S.
Yeah, sorrow, I feel, has a very special place in the culture. There's a real significant spiritual element to it. Rumi talks about it a lot, that it's only through that suffering that your heart is sort of burned. And through that burning, you achieve a closer proximity to the beloved with a capital B.
Uh-huh.
So we take our suffering very seriously.
I was just going to ask you, you moved here when you were six, right?
We left Iran when I was six and seven when we arrived.
Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering about the culture, you know, shock both for you and your parents in that, you know, we are not a culture that tends to see the value of suffering, let us say. You know, was that all part of a cultural transition for you and your family?
There were so many cultural transitions. I mean, just the supermarket versus the bazaar is a huge right. cultural transition.
Right.
It's not just suffering. It's the closeness to the spiritual. You know, when you walk the streets of Tehran, there's a certain magic that you feel very close to. I don't know how else to say it. Here, we kind of, I don't know if it's the way we've trained our minds. We're very mathematical, logical, scientific oriented. Or just the particular, you know, merging of different cultures. Something is taken out of, say, the streets of Los Angeles, unless you're in a particular neighborhood that's, let's say, primarily Latino, where you do feel something that we call magical realism. I'm not very fond of that term, but mm-hmm. there's this spirituality that exists as a part of the day-to-day experience that exists in Iran. It's sort of been weeded out of our cultural experience in the U.S.
Well, when I was there, every other person made a joke to me when they found out where I was from, made a joke about Erangelis or Tehrangelis, right? When your family moved here, did you move into a community so that you were part of a Persian experience still or not?
No, unfortunately or fortunately, they decided to settle in a suburb of Los Angeles that was predominantly Caucasian, upper middle class, and very Republican oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1984. Reagan was president. Mm. You know, the Iran hostage crisis was fresh in everyone's memory. Oliver North was in. It was not a good time to be Iranian in a neighborhood of no Iranians.
Now it's easy, right? Now it's great to be Iranian.
Yeah, perfect.
America,
yeah, no, it's now
it's
now
like
we're
a festival. But did your parents not realize that when they picked the neighborhood?
Well, we did not come with a lot of money, so settling in the Beverly Hills area was not an option. And then, you know, settling in the valley, my parents were very focused on our education. That's one of the reasons why we escaped. And there was a good school district. So that's where they decided. I'm grateful for having grown up in that particular setting. It's kind of allowed me to be audience to myself. It's given me a very metacognitive understanding of my relationship to, you know, larger social picture. And then also, I've sort of grown up this way from the get-go. My mother comes from a Jewish background. My father comes from a Muslim background. So in both situations, I was never part of that either particular society either. So
the book itself feels very much like a Bible story in a certain way. I'm curious where the story came from. Was it something, had you heard the story? Did you just completely generate it yourself? What was the genesis, as it were?
The bones of the story, like I said, it's a family story. The elders would sit around and tell the story of this, the central character, Rachel. They referred to her as Dada. And when they would talk about her, she's this monstrous woman. They knew her as an older woman. They were children themselves. And I would sit around and I would listen to the elders talk. They would laugh and they would do this sort of communal storytelling. One person would throw something in another and they would just build Kermanshah right in front of you. You know, it was marvelous. When I started writing, I wanted to know more about how any human being can become so epic. Rachel is epic. She's, in their stories, she's gargantuous, you know. And so I started asking, well, what was she like as a child? And the only thing they knew was she couldn't have a baby, and she was a bread maker's daughter, and her husband took a second wife. That's it. So then I figured, you know, as a storyteller, where I wanted to begin was to begin with this story of how she became that monster of their stories. The part about it being very biblical, I started noticing as I was writing the story, almost everybody's name has been kept in as it is. And I started noticing this strange correlation between their particular experiences, characters, and their biblical story that matches. Rachel couldn't have a child, you know, and she was extremely jealous, you know. Yusuf was, Yaakov loses Yusuf, you know, Joseph, and yearns. And so there's this yearning for Yusuf. You know, there's Ibrahim sacrifices his son. And it was very strange. And so then I decided, well, I mean, if this exists, might as well go ahead and tap into those biblical stories.
What a gift they gave you.
Indeed.
Have any of them read the book?
Well, they're all dead. They've been dead for some time. My grandmother the Mahbubeh, the narrator, is fashioned after my maternal grandmother. And she is actually in the process of dying as we speak. She's on a hospice. And she is well into dementia now. The story begins at the onset of her dementia. And there's a very particular reason why I chose that sort of unreliable narrator to tell the story.
And then did you, in fact, do a lot of research to find out the real details of the real story?
Yes.
And how did you do that research?
I did a lot of research to find out the details of the real everything. I would cross-reference everything, and what I started noticing was there was a lot of conflict in narratives, in the oral storytelling, in the actual historical narratives, depending on who was telling it. It was really hard to find a concrete truth. And I mentioned the unreliable narrator. That's why I decided to begin to tell the story through the point of view of an unreliable narrator. One of the themes I'm exploring is that all narratives, including historical narratives, are constructed by the imagination. You know, there's truth is this sort of malleable substance. It's not concrete. You know, it's not, you know, the prologue sort of presents two versions of the same story.
The novel is The Girl from the Garden, Parnaz Fodertan. Thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
Thanks to Parnaz Fodertan, David Shields, LARB editor Sarah Messley. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour on 90.7 KPFK FM. Go to iTunes and give us a rating, Lori, right?
Yeah, I think we deserve a rating, like a high rate, a very high, how high, many, very, very
how
high.
Many stars should they give us?
How many are there?
I think there are 5.
They should give us 10.